My name's Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello,
Burns. Hi, everybody. I need to tell you just, I need to share things with you. I want you to feel that I'm a part of you, you know, and you're a part of me. So I wore this suit for the first time since last summer, and I've gained 10 pounds. And I've got my top button undone and half my fly unzipped so that I can breathe. And I feel close to you somehow, and I wanted to share that with you. And I can tell you I'm a lot closer to you than I was before I unzipped this fly. I have not been known to projectile vomit sober, but I was afraid I was going to tonight if I didn't unzip my fly. So I needed to start off that way for some reason. Anybody, those of you who are here from the treatment center, are saying, what the hell is he doing that for? You know? And even those of you've been here for a while say, what the hell is he doing that for? But I just want to be a part of you so bad, you know, and be accepted and loved. I've noticed the problem with this conference is you people are just too damn tense, you know. I mean, I knew last night that it was going to be something special when Jim forgot to have the countdown, count it, whatever y'all have, and interrupted right after the Serenity Prayer so we could start it over, and the young lady who was up here decided we wouldn't read how it works. I was just wonderful. I love the whole thing. I mean, and then Scott finished talking, and nobody had his gift, and I thought, they really believe that nobody is in charge of this place, I can tell you. And I said, so Saturday night I'll come. Somebody's got to take this group over and lead them out of this mess. But that is a tribute to John. John is able to lead by example and not have to pull these reins in. And I appreciate very much your calling me and asking me to talk. It's been a very special time being here. I've been deeply affected, starting from just getting here and Gay picking us up at the airport and driving. We did drive over in incredibly bad weather, and it was just neat. You know, I tell you what's neat about it is I kept thinking, these people really want to have a conference. You know, I mean, because I grew up in a place in western Kentucky, which is much like Greenville. Damn it, you got to want to go there bad to get there, you know. I'm serious. I mean, in Mayfield, y'all do have planes that fly in here. We didn't have planes that flew in there, so we had to drive. And so I found out to get to Greenville to come to a conference, you really got to want to do that. And the Spirit really tells me that. You know, I immediately saw what y'all have here and thought this was wonderful. And I thought, what they need to, this is me. You understand? And those of you who know me understand why I would say this. They got to get a bigger place so they can get more people in so they can do this even bigger, you know? It ain't broken. I'm going to fix it anyway. Hell, why not? That's what I do best, is cause confusion. I mean, I'm sure none of y'all can relate to that. People you've been around y'all their life can sure as hell relate to it, but y'all can't relate to that, you know? But it was wonderful driving over and talking with her. We stopped at a little filling station, and Gay went in with us, and I was sitting there looking at her, and we'd been talking, and I thought, she doesn't look right. And, I'm talking about, y'all may think she doesn't look right all the time, but I mean, she didn't particularly look right at that particular time. She looked different. And I said, are you tired? And she said, well, no, I'm not tired. And I said, I hugged her. I said, hug me. So we hugged, and I said, what's the matter? And you know, it's kind of like she'd been away from the baby. You know, and that was really neat. I mean, I don't know if there's anything any more beautiful when it dawned on me that this was a mother who was being away from a baby for 4 hours, 5-month-old baby, and this was really magnificent to me. And it really told me that, you know, she'd driven over there to get Casey and me and was going to be gone from her baby for 4 hours, and that was a significant move on her part, a significant move of love, you know. And I thought, we're going to have a hell of a time. It's just the way it's going to be. And we got here, and then today Kenny took us out to the place and gave us the honor and dignity of showing us his home and looking around. Looking at John, looking at Kenny's baby pictures, and looking at John, my God in heaven, you know, I mean, it looks like they stamped one out 50 years later, and there it was, you know. Haven't had one look like that. Okay, God, here, just get another one. But it was just magnificent to be a part of this community. I'm safe here. I feel safe here. And I've talked a lot of places and been a lot of places in my life where I may have done a decent job and I really didn't know I was there doing God's will as best I could figure it, but I never particularly felt like I was belonged there, and it wasn't just all me, or didn't really feel all that safe there, but I feel safe here. Which means God knows I may sing for the night's over. Hell, I don't know. I really never know. And I'm sure God says, you think that's my will? You read the wrong book, jackass, and you'll start over. But I do feel safe here. The speakers, I'm far enough along in recovery that I have enough sense to be afraid of somebody drunk with a gun. But I don't get afraid of much anymore except things that I should be afraid of. So I'm not afraid to speak in this parade of speakers. I feel real honored to be in this parade of speakers. But I will tell you one thing. I don't know that I've ever been more singularly affected by a group of speakers than I have by the speakers that have been here this weekend. And I have no reason to believe that Sunday morning will be any different, because I've heard Karen, one of her last talks in Alabama, and to be magnificent. When I listened to Scott last night, I've never really heard my story in AA. And I didn't hear it last night. But I've very rarely even listened to a speaker that I thought reminded me of me. That's, I just never have. But, my God, when I listened to him last night, I thought, I knew at times what he was going to say before he opened his mouth. And I'd never heard him before. Because my mind is just like his. About the only thing I'm really afraid of in my whole life is me and my mind. Because I tell you, that sucker can make me believe that blue is green flying upside down on a frog. You know, that's just the way I am. I mean, that's just the way I am. And I watched his mind, and I thought, my God in heaven, it was incredible. And I was with him every minute. And Jim, in all honesty, I was at Jim's place in Alabama not too long ago talking at a conference that he chairs. And I've loved Jim Miller for a long time. I've respected him for a long time. We had been apart for quite a while, and it may be some of the dynamic that's changing in their lives right now, and I'm sure it is, because I also love Christy. And I'm sure that plays a part in it. But Jim affected me deeply today, talking about the changes in their lives and the depth of the spirituality and the trust and the love that's going on with him and Christy and the whole family, the whole thing. And I told him that. I don't think I could adequately tell you, except just to say how much you mean to me and how much that talk meant to me. I'm very fond of the morning speaker, only because she has saved my ass so many times that I just can't begin to tell you how many times, obviously, for those of you who don't know, the morning speaker is my wife, gave an incredible AA talk. I don't know that I've ever met a human being in my life that I've gotten to know very intimately that I respect and love any more than I do my wife. She is truly the most honest, the most sincere, and the most spiritual human being I've ever known. And that's the truth. Here lately, honest to God, I've been telling her that in private, too. I don't know how much of the story will come out, but for me to be saying that is I never quit loving her, but I sure did do a number on our marriage. Not because I'm a bad person, but I got to tell you, if there was ever an alcoholic that starts with a capital A and ends with a capital C, you're looking at him. And if you think I'm unique, then look in the mirror. So let's go, okay? This talk is for the newcomer. It's also for me. It's for that individual who has been sober 1 year and has finally decided they burned their brain up and they're just absolutely terrified because they still can't find their car in a parking lot. It's for the person with 2 years who thinks he's just absolutely got it all together right now. He has found the answer and he's really ready to go. And the one with 5 years who has decided that if he doesn't shoot himself or if they don't have all the guns, he's going to. And the one with 10 years who really does have it wired, who doesn't really need to tell anybody about it anymore, he just knows he's got it, And the one with 20 years who decides that you know, that he really doesn't need to go to regular AA meetings. They'll have these private meetings on the side. And the one with 30 years, he doesn't have to have a sponsor because they don't need a sponsor. And the one with 42 years, whose wife died, who was lonely and decided his new girlfriend who drank wine with dinner, he should drink wine with her too because he didn't want to lose her because he was so lonely. That's what this talk's about, because I made 12 step calls on every one of those people. And I won't talk about that. I decided some time ago that it was more important for me to tell the things that I have experienced and the things that I have learned in AA, because I just finally got tired of burying people. You know, and I know I'm not in charge of who lives or dies, but I'm damn sure in charge of carrying every message, every minute of every message I've got, because somebody out there may actually be listening. And I want to be real sure that when they make that decision, that I've given them everything I've got, that decision of whether they want to live or die. And that's exactly what every alcoholic has to decide. You want to live or you want to die. Because this disease is 100% fatal. I don't mean to preach or teach when I give this talk, but I do both. And the fact is, I don't apologize for either, because if there hadn't been preachers and teachers in my life, I'd be dead. So sometimes when I get to preaching and teaching, those of you who want to take a nap, go ahead. Those of you who are inspired, you know, cry and share and clap and do the things you want to do. And those of you who are just waiting and tolerating me till I get through with it, just go ahead and do that too. But that's I'll do quite a bit of that. The miracle of recovery. You know, this room is full of miracles. And any alcoholic who's in this room who's breathing and not drunk is a miracle. Because every one of us should be dead. Yeah? And the fact is, if we don't stay sober and do the things we need to do to stay sober, each one of us will be dead. And I've become fascinated by looking at this miracle of recovery. And some of the insights that I've gained in this miracle of recovery, and I used to make it real complicated, and today I don't find it to be really that complicated anymore, at least not today. Fascinating thing about observing people and watching this miracle of recovery. This miracle of recovery for me has come, and I'll give you the examples I've seen. There's a beautiful couple from Bessemer, Alabama. She's the alcoholic, he is the, he's the Al-Anon. I guess they've been around 15 years. Is that about right, Bo? Surely about 15 years. And they had a son, a beautiful son. His early 20s. He wasn't an alcoholic. He got killed in a car wreck. This was approximately, I'm going to say, 8 years ago. And I watched Shirley go into this rigid, fishwife, hate God, why did it happen to me, is there any God, the whole deal. And she continued to talk from the podium. And I watched her start this journey of hate and victimization, and why me, God, and is there a God, and if there is, you got no guts. Same thing we've all felt, right? But she continued to talk, and I was privileged to see her at intervals so that I could see this change occurring. And I saw this evolution begin to take place that only can be described as a miracle, because, I mean, this was a tragic death for which there seemed to be no logical reason or answer or rhyme or reason. And I began to see her mellow. And I began to see her move in that direction, away from the hatred and the venom and the victimization. And she talked at that conference that Jim had down in Georgia. And Jim had taken us over to Callaway Gardens, and there's a conservatory there that's full of all. The boy's name was Mike. And there's a conservatory there that has all these butterflies in them, thousands of butterflies. And it's a wonderful place to walk in, and the butterflies are around you, and it's perfectly temperature controlled, and it's an incredible little Valhalla. And we're sitting there talking, and this butterfly came and landed on Shirley's stomach. And just gradually walked up her stomach and right out the end of her breast. And she looked at me and looked down at that butterfly, and she said, "Burns, that's Michael coming to tell me it's okay." And 8 years ago, where is God? And 8 years later, this is Michael coming to tell. It doesn't matter to me what you think about that event. What matters to me is that the miracle of recovery allowed this individual to see the same thing through a different pair of glasses. And I came to know that the miracle of recovery is not necessarily a change in what I see. It's a change in how I see it. Did you listen to Jim today? What you heard over and over in that talk, in that miracle talk, was not, I've been kicked, I've been beat, what is happening, our family is going down the tubes. Oh, no, what he kept talking about was this opportunity, this window for this beautiful change. Instead of sitting there with the venom of, my wife has done this, oh, my God, what has happened? No, it was a talk of hope. What he's seen hasn't changed. It's how he's seen it. Peggy M. from Nebraska, I listened to her talk about 2 years ago, and she was talking about when she first got sober. You remember when you first got sober, how you sit there and you can't be sure what's winter or summer? Only thing you can be sure is what kind of clothes you're wearing when you walk out the door. That tells you whether it's winter or summer, you know? Somebody dresses you and you walk out, if they put a coat on you, it's probably winter. If you're going out in a short sleeve shirt, I'm telling you the truth. Maybe you didn't get that drunk. Maybe your recovery wasn't that bad. Hell, I used to lose my car drunk all the time. I lost it sober for a year. I lost my car in an 11-place parking lot next to my office. Now, I could practice medicine, but I couldn't cognitively think. You know? You know what it was like, and that's where Peggy was when she first got sober, and it was in the winter in Nebraska, and she would go out every morning and do something like what we can do, and that is go to the bathroom, make sure our pants are down, make sure they're up when we finish, and then go do something that might be constructive, like go to a meeting, call your sponsor, in this case, going out and feeding the animals. And she would go out there and put down the food, and the foxes would come up and eat the food, and she would go back in, and she'd come out the next day and put the food down. Her sponsor said, feed the animals, and that's what she did. In the spring, she went out, and she was still feeding the animals, and she laid down the food and turned to walk in and felt something, turned around here. She said there was this fox sitting there about 5 feet away from her with its paws out in the front of it, its back legs pulled up underneath it, looking her right straight in the eye. And she said, I could look in that fox's eyes, and what that fox was saying was, thank you, Peggy, for saving my babies. And I'm sitting there listening to her say that, and I said, hell, man, I've hunted all my life, and I've seen I don't know how many wild animals in that stance, and what they're saying is, you make one move, sucker, and I'll bite your leg off, you know? I mean, that's what I see. And I realize that intellectually what I see is closer to the truth than what she sees. But what matters is what she saw for her. And the miracle of recovery is not a change in what she saw. It's a change in how she saw it. And I won't tell you about that miracle of recovery in my life. My talk is kind of weird the way I'm doing it today, but that figures, knowing me, I'm the one I'm doing it, because I do that. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, my birthday is December the 1st, 1977. And when I came in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, when I got home from treatment in... I guess it was March of 78. I came into AA in what I call the dark ages of Alcoholics Anonymous in Louisville, Kentucky. To be quite honest, it was in the dark ages of Alcoholics Anonymous in many parts of this country, because it had turned predominantly into a program of personalities and not principles. And certainly in Louisville, which I'm intimately familiar with at that point in time and today, the whole pitch was, when you came in, don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, tell him what's wrong with you, he'll tell you what to do, then you do what he tells you to do, and then go save a drunk. And that was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I was willing to be told, and I was willing to be led, so that's what I did. And for the first 9 years in AA, I read the Big Book one time. My first fourth step was in a treatment program, which was a personal history. My second fourth step was a 300-question questionnaire from Hazleton, which wasn't where I was in treatment, but that was when I was 2 years sober. That's what my sponsor had me do. My third fourth step was a 250 questionnaire that my sponsor made up. Now, I mean to tell you, for 9 years in this program, I had a 3 1/3 step program. I had the first three steps wired. I knew damn well I was powerless over alcohol. It whipped my butt. Now, not only was I powerless because I couldn't quit drinking, I was powerless because I couldn't make it work. I could drink enough whiskey that I could stop the shaking and the diarrhea and the withdrawal, but I couldn't stop the noise. I couldn't stop the turmoil. I couldn't stop the feelings. All I could do was just stop shaking and quit puking and quit having diarrhea. So I knew I was powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. You damn whistling, I knew my life was unmanageable. Because when I went into treatment, the first treatment program I was in for 3 weeks, my roommate hanged himself in the closet, and I'm sitting there looking at him hanging in the closet. And I thought, good God, you know, my life is unmanageable. And I really knew it would take a power greater than me to restore me to sanity, and I was willing to follow directions. And the third step was a bit hard for me, not because I wasn't willing to accept it and adopt it. I didn't understand it. And I'm a doctor who believes in cause and effect. I don't know whether I believe in it. I'm trained in it. And when I would look at that third step, which is an abstract concept, and let me tell you what we know about abstract concepts as alcoholics for 2 years, is we can't spell abstract. And yet I'm also dealing with this provincial thinking where I have to define the third step. I mean, I just intuitively have to define the third step. And I was going nuts. So what I did for almost 2 years, the first 2 or 3 years for the third step, was I remember when I was a little boy in the Baptist church in Mayfield, Kentucky, I'd rock in Sunday school kindergarten, 5 years old, and they'd say, God is love. So I would just rock and say, God is love. When I'd get under stress, I would just go somewhere and sit quietly and rock and say, God is love. And that made me feel good. So that was it. And that was fine. And if you're struggling with the third step, then let me tell you what your best bet is if you're struggling with a third step is go ahead and do a fourth one. You can sit there till the cows come home and you can flat run your head up your butt till your brains fall out and you'll never be able to define it in that first 3 years of sobriety trying to define the third step. And if somebody tells you to go back to the second step, you tell them, thank you, I'll go to the fourth. I've never seen anything happen going ass backwards. Most of it happens when you go face forward, okay? A little bit of preaching there, and now I'll get back to my story, all right? Wait till I get to be 40 years sober. God, I may be lethal, right? In any event, I had the first three steps, and I had that third of the 12th step because, I mean, I was all over Louisville, Kentucky. The story was, here he comes. You better drink a beer because he's going to put you in treatment anyway. I mean, I was everywhere. I was a lethal weapon for God. I mean, I was just everywhere. Now, the fact of the matter was, in all of that, I noticed that all these people that I would get into treatment and drag off to places, they would come back and stick around with us for a while. The ones who had any sense kind of disappeared. They started going to their other meetings and all. And I didn't care. I thought, well, they just don't want to get the best. I wasn't talking about me. I was talking about an enclave of some of us. There were about 10 of us. And thank God the fellowship was indescribably beautiful because I hung on to about 5 or 6 guys in the program. And if they sit down on a commode, I sit down on the one next to them. If they went to play golf, I went to play golf. If they went to church, I went to church. I mean to tell you, we almost kissed each other goodnight every single night for 9 years. I mean, that was the way, and I've got to tell you, it was wonderful because I wanted to be a part of, and that's what this fellowship can be. You can be a part of. You'll find we played golf together. We did everything together. Then our wives would get involved in this thing. We did everything together. It was wonderful. And I still know, these guys, I love them today. I love them today. But I got to tell you, at 9 years in this program, I was goofier than a goat. Absolutely goofier than a 3 1/3 step program just won't cut it. You know? And at 9 years in this program, driven by a series of events to my knees of my own self-centeredness, I was given Joe and Charlie's tapes of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you how I got there. All alcoholics take hostages. Sometimes we call them pigeons. Sometimes we call them sponsorees. You show me somebody with 40 pigeons, and I'll show you somebody that's sicker than hell. And they just will. I just will. That's just what they are. I mean, they haven't got 40 sponsorees. They got 40 hostages. And it's notching their belt. I could be wrong, but rarely. In any event, we all take hostages. My biggest hostage was Casey. I mean, I'd had a real bad divorce for 17 years. Then I got drunk enough to make my wife mad enough to kick me out. Then I ran wild for about a year, and then ran into Casey, and you heard her story, those of you who are here, but we ran into each other, and our anniversary, not our wedding anniversary, but our anniversary of coming together was on Derby Eve, and this is Kentucky Derby in Louisville, and it's a big event, and on Friday night before Derby, we ran into each other, and we've never been apart. Literally have never been apart. Well, we were for a little while, and we went to Florida. You know, I know But I knew you were, knew the big dog was going to do, you want to go to Florida? Yeah. I mean, for a Kentucky boy, going to Florida is it, you know. I said, I'm going to make a move on this woman. You want to go to Florida? You know, hell, it don't get no better than that. You want to go to, every time. Works every time, you know. That's right. And so she went, and as we were coming back after that week in Florida on the plane, I said, now, you got to realize that we just can't be together like this from now on. And she said, I understand. I said, you got to realize we're going to have to be apart some. She said, I realize we got to be apart some. So we landed. I took her to work and went home, got my clothes, picked her up, and moved in with her that night. We've never been apart since then. So that was our anniversary. Well, it was a wonderful relationship like she talked about. I mean, I bought her clothes. I never asked her what kind she wanted. I bought her cars. Never asked her what kind of car she wanted. I planned wonderful vacations, never asked her if she wanted to go there. I took her to wonderful meetings, never asked her if those were the meetings she wanted to go to. It was just, and I mean, everything was wonderful. I gave her everything I had. All I asked in return was everything back exactly the way I wanted it. And she did it. Wasn't a bad life. You know, I was a benevolent dictator. It was a pretty wonderful life. And then lo and behold, she comes up to me after 7 years of recovery and says, Burns, I've never loved you more, but I want to go back to college. I want to go into therapy, and I want to start attending my own meetings. And what did I hear? You're leaving me. You know, that's not what she said. That's what I heard. Now, let me tell you what my relationship with women is. You read the four steps as we go back through our lives, nothing counts but thoroughness and honesty. Right? Fifth chapter, four step. So, in going back, so this isn't analytical. We go back and we look at those things. My mother, my grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. They had an interesting way of treating my grandfather in the middle 30s. When he'd get drunk, they'd put him in jail. When he'd sober up, they'd put him in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. And my mother used to walk past her daddy at least once a week in the chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. The red letter was not adultery. It was alcoholism. My mother never really ever recovered from that. She wasn't an alcoholic. Today we call it an adult child syndrome. All you got to do is read the family afterward. It tells you, if you're around one of us, you get goofy. Now, Wilson called it neurotic. I just call it goofy. And mother was goofy. She was lovely, and I think a mama every day. She died in 78. But my mother was goofy. She was goofy from the disease of alcoholism. Her whole ego and her whole alter ego came through me and my brother, her boys. I was the first Brady who ever went to college. And my daddy told me, he said it was, and I always wondered why I wanted to be a doctor. My daddy said, well, I'll tell you why you wanted to be a doctor, Burns Mack. He said, when I walked into the hospital room and the first day your mother was holding you, and she looked up at me and she said, Hal, she said, this one's going to be a doctor. Hell, I was primed to be a doctor. I'm sure my mother put me up, going to be a doctor. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not bitching about it. But why do I want to be a doctor? Going to be a doctor. I mean, that's just the way it was. Well, I found out that when I was perfect in this quest, when I was Jack Armstrong, the All-American boy, Mama was happy. When I wasn't Jack Armstrong, the All-American boy, Mama wouldn't talk to me. So I became Jack Armstrong, the All-American boy. And when I was the All-American boy, she buffeted my butt and parted my little hair and picked up my underwear, and she made me king baby. And what I began to realize that the deal was, without even thinking about it, I didn't realize it, it was just intuitive, that a woman's role in my life was to take care of me and make me feel special. And that became my job description for all women, without knowing it. Now, you've got to realize that there are a lot of women that came in for one reason or another. Maybe it's because I'm not particularly a dog, and I can be gracious and all that other stuff. So I had a number of women came in my life. Most of them didn't stay very long, at least not the sane ones. Hell, they got the hell out. The ones who stayed were just goofy as goats. I mean, they were really goofy. And they stayed around during that time, except for Casey. Now, she came in, and she was very special. In fact, knowing that I had something special in my life was part of the equation of my wanting to get sober, because I did not want to lose her. She was the first lady I'd had in my life who was very special. But it was this deal of take care of me and make me feel special. Now she's leaving me, so what do I automatically begin to do? What am I going to do? Find another woman. Right? I'm not even looking for one. It's just like the rocks in my head started looking for a woman who would fit the holes in hers, you know? And sure enough, I found one. And I began this fantasy relationship with this woman in my office. I had one problem. I've been around y'all for 9 years. And I realized what I was doing simply wasn't honest, and I'd really been drilled in the fact that you can't stay sober if you can't be honest. And this wasn't honest. I even fantasized that if I worked it just right, I was really sure, since I knew Casey was a wonderful woman, and this other woman that was all a fantasy relationship. But I knew she was a real neat lady, too, so I figured that maybe we all three could live together. I mean, why not? Why not? Now, Casey had never heard this because I never had the guts to tell it before, I guess. I probably had more sense than to tell it before then. You people have got me telling more than I ever really intended to say between my fly and this story. Hell, I better go on. I may not have a home, but never. But in any event, I mean, I reached that point, and I mean, I was really seesawed with this deal because I knew I loved this one, and I had a history with her, and I felt this thing that we feel, which is love. Let me tell you what, I found out one thing about feelings about that time. They're never to be ignored, but by God, they're never to be trusted. Because I can sit there and I can feel stupid. I can feel what the lump in my pants is. You know, I mean, I can feel. What do you feel? Well, hell, I'm not even in the same room, but I feel it, you know. That's why sponsors are wonderful. They help you know what is bullshit and what's not bullshit, you know, because of what you feel. But I had these feelings, and I thought that was it. And I didn't know what to do, and I was screaming for help. And this little pigeon, when I found this program, when the student's ready, the teacher will always arrive. Always arrive. And this little pigeon of mine came up and gave me these 8 tapes and said, listen to these and see if they're any good. And they were Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book. And as I listened to those tapes, I just cried all the way through them because I knew the program I didn't have. I had 11 copies made, and 12 of us guys went into a Big Book study at that time, and my life began to change. Not only did we study the book, we did what it told us to do, and we really intensively began to pursue this program and design for living as outlined in our manual for living. And my life changed. And if anybody's been around for a while and they don't have a 12-step program and they're not following the directions that I will hopefully outline, it may help you, that certainly have been outlined for me and that I try to do today, then I'd suggest you consider whether or not you've got a 3-step program or a 5-step program or what you've got. I'm always fascinated by the number of meetings I go to where you're sitting in a room and somebody says, well, that's a 3rd-step problem. You've got to turn it over. And I'm sitting there thinking, God said, turn it over my ass. You know, what you got to do is, this is where you get started. I watch so many people stop at the 3rd step on page 449 in the Big Book instead of realizing that's the place to start. That's the place to start. And even in the Big Book, the 3rd step, it tells us this is only the beginning. And I watch so many people in meetings say it's a 3rd-step problem. Almost every problem I've ever had is a 12-step problem, not a 3rd-step problem. But in any event, my life changed. And as I became a student of this book, I noticed some interesting things. The first thing I found out is that my problem's not alcohol. And I'm going to tell you, if you're an alcoholic of my type, your problem's not alcohol. Now, I'm what's known as an addictionist. I've got qualifications, and I've taken exams that says I'm a specialist in the field of addiction. One of my students there at the medical school told me the other day, well, after listening to your story and listening to what you know, you ought to be a specialist in this field. You are your own lab rat. I said, you're right, you know. And she was right. But I can put on this whole wall up here all the formulas that showed what Silkworth was saying when he said we have a physical allergy and mental obsession. Wilson and Silkworth would have loved to have been alive today, because all it does is validate exactly what they said at that time, only we got formulas and things to go with it. And we're learning every day more about this physical allergy and mental obsession. So if you're an alcoholic of my type, you're never going to be able to drink alcohol like a normal person. You're playing 2 sandwiches short of a picnic and being able to drink alcohol. Okay? But I need to tell you, if you haven't heard it before, your problem's not alcohol. And I can tell you for damn sure my problem's not alcohol. Now, alcohol caused me a lot of problems, and I can't drink it, but it's not my problem. And the book told me my problem was the 6 inches between my ears. It's called my mind. And he defined it classically as the peculiar mental twist. Now, if you think we think like normal people, then you haven't been out there in the real public very long, have you? I practiced family medicine for 25 years, and I saw thousands of people walk into my office, and they all reacted with fear when there should be fear. They all reacted with anger when it was appropriate. But they don't react at a red light like we do. You know, you're sitting at a red light, and somebody honks the horn, and your first impulse, I don't care what it is to give them the sign, you know? And I mean, then the second one is to come out of there and kick their ass, you know? Now, let me tell you what the first step in recovery is. You start to look in the rearview mirror before you get out of the car. That shows your judgment's getting intact. And then as you stay around the program longer, you begin to bring your finger in and start to say a prayer for whoever's behind you, you know? But we do that at a red light. I do that at a red light. And the way you're laughing, you do that at a red light, right? Not everybody does that at red lights. All drunks do it at red lights, but not everybody else. So, no, we don't think like normal people. Sitting in the meeting, somebody says, well, so-and-so drank. Why did he drink? Because he's an alcoholic. And that's the dumbest damn thing you can ever say. Now, the fact is, it's true. But it's the dumbest thing you can say in a meeting. He drank. Hell, I remember when I came in, I used to be afraid I was going to get struck drunk. I mean, I'm 42 years old at that time, and I'm a well-qualified physician, and I would sit at a red light thinking, oh, God, don't let me be struck drunk. Please don't let me be struck drunk. They'll never believe me. That guy last night drank because he's an alcoholic. I'm not going to drink, but hell, I'll be struck drunk, and they'll never believe a damn word I've told them. That's just the way it is. And I'd go into a meeting, somebody said, I got a problem. I got a problem. I'm going to be struck drunk, and I'd do that. And you got somebody like me sitting there and saying, well, so-and-so drank because he's an alcoholic. Well, when's my time? Oh, God, no. When's my time? Think about it. Maybe none of y'all were that tight. I mean, my rectum was about that big for the first 5 years in this program. Hell, man. I had to have Vaseline to go to the bathroom. And you said... And you're sitting there, and you're sitting there, and you sit in a meeting and hear that kind of stuff, and because I believed everything I heard. So when's my time? A peculiar mental twist. Yeah, he drank or she drank because they're alcoholic. But it's because of the way I think. The peculiar mental twist. And I want to talk to you about the peculiar mental twist. I want to tell you the kind of thinking that I do, that I have to deal with this program that we share on a daily basis. Because when people come in, I remember one of the first times I heard somebody come in and got drunk. And I turned to my first sponsor and I said, why did so-and-so, so-and-so got drunk Saturday night. And he said, I said, so-and-so had a slip Saturday night. He said, no, they didn't. They drank Saturday night. They had a slip about 6 months ago. Because that's when the thinking starts. You know, there have been people who have made a fortune, and frankly, I applaud them, talking about relapse dynamics. And you in the treatment program and some of the other people here will be taught relapse dynamics. The big book tells us it's all there. It's going to happen if we don't maintain the spiritual condition, right? So I want to share that. First, I want to start with a joke that's an alcoculic joke. Those of you who heard me talk have heard this. I've been telling it for 5 years, but I love it because it tells about an alcoholic. I was down in West Texas, or East Texas, talking. There's a fellow down there named Damon. Damon died about 90 years old and about 50 years sober. And he was the voice of a conference that I was speaking at, and Damon always talked like he had a flat brainwave. But if you got real close to him and listened, he was extremely humorous. And he was telling this story about this traveling salesman, and it's what we used to call in Western Kentucky bad to drink. He said this salesman would travel from town to town to town, and he would spend a week in this particular motel like the Ramada here, and when he'd check in, he'd get drunk. He'd work all day, go out that night, and get drunk, come back in, and they'd do things to set him up to get his business. And he did this for years, and finally he had all his fun he could tolerate, so he goes home, gets into AA, goes into 28-day treatment program, intensive outpatient program. I don't know what he does, but he comes back sober. So he starts making this cycle again. He checks into the Ramada. Works all day. That night he comes in, has his dinner, goes out to a meeting, comes back, and they assume he's going out to get drunk like he always has. So he comes in and opens the door and flips on the light, and they've got him set up to keep his business. And they're set next to the bed is a quart of whiskey and a tub of ice. And on the foot of the bed sat these two beautiful women. He said, well, I've started going to AA, and I asked them what I needed to do to be happy and stay sober, and they told me I couldn't drink, and I had to change everything I'm doing. So I can't drink that whiskey. And one of you girls is going to have to leave. That's a real drunk, isn't it? I mean, that's exactly the way we think. It may be half measures, but it's the peculiar mental twist. First part of the peculiar mental twist for Burns Brady is being bigger than the rules. Listen to speakers talk about it. Listen to the person who read, being bigger than the rules. And let me tell you, Silkworth said in his chapter that if these men, and he talked about men because there were essentially no women, if these men follow a few simple rules. I've watched people that I've tried to work with. I'm not going to practice any rules. I'm glad they say suggestions. When I came in here, I was begging you to have rules and that you would teach them to me and I could follow them. You know, I could follow those rules. I had a design for living that told me what to do. So, yeah, we have rules, and my first part of my peculiar mental twist is being bigger than the rules. I've got 9 points on my driver's license. I have this tendency when I get in a 65-mile-an-hour speed zone to go 95 miles an hour. It just pisses off the police every single time. And they pull me over, and they give me a ticket. And I was sitting at home the other night, and I was thinking, why'd I do that? I thought, well, I'm not stupid. I'm not crazy. The only reason I can figure out is I do it because I'm Burns Brady. I thought, that's it. You do it because you're Burns Brady. Yeah. Bigger than the rules. Handicapped parking zones. I know you can't go in it, John. But I'm just going into the post office for 15 seconds. I can pull in there and go in the post office. Why? Because I'm Burns Brady. You know? Now, the psychiatrists call this narcissism. And my standing diagnosis for all those psychiatric admissions was psychopathological narcissistic sociopathic personality disorder. That's my psychiatric diagnosis, and the damn diagnosis is right, you know, because they diagnosed my behavior, and that's the way I behave. Even sober, it's the way I behave.
This is the end of side one.
You know, and you can take that to one. I'll tell you where I can take it. It's the morning I get up and don't do the 11th step. Dear God, direct my thinking. Keep my thoughts free from self-centeredness, dishonesty, and self-pity. You know the drill. If you haven't, then you need to get a sponsor and learn the drill. And that morning I get up and I don't start with that 11th step prayer. And I don't start with that 3rd step prayer and that 7th step prayer. And I don't sit there and take 5 or 10 or 15 minutes and quietly let the power of my God come into my body and into my soul, because that day will be okay no matter what happens. Why don't I do that every morning? Because I've known after 20 years that works. So why don't I do it every morning? You tell me. Because I'm Burns Brady. And I don't close my night at night by saying, dear God, and start with a beautiful 11-step simple prayer to inventory my day, to set it right so I don't have to have that garbage the next morning to go with me. It's a better morning when I get up after I've closed it right. Why don't I do it? Because I'm Burns Brady. Wilson knew that we wouldn't be able to spell narcissism, most of us. And he knew that we might not even be able to figure out being bigger than the rules. So what did he call it? Self-centeredness. First part of the peculiar mental twist and its manifestations, being bigger than the rules, self-centeredness. Second part of the peculiar mental twist, victimization. Listen to the speakers. You're my problem. If this woman hadn't gone back to college, by God, I wouldn't be in this mess. Oh, it started early in life for me because I was born very poor. Oh, I milked this sucker. You drank, too. You drank, too, if you couldn't belong to the country club. You had to walk down that fairway carrying those bags and watch those little rich bastards dive in that swimming pool, you know. Oh, Lord God, I just walked it right down that fairway. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you drank, too, if your mother and daddy couldn't afford you a car. You drank, too, if college, you had to work your way through college. You drank, too, if you had to marry that rich bitch that had all that money and you hated her guts when you married her, but she had all that money, you know. Oh, victimization. I mean, everything. Listen to the victimization. You know what Wilson called it? He called it self-pity. You want to really look at what self-pity is? I'll tell you what it is for Burns Brady. It's victimization. Why me? You're my problem. Tom, you caused it. Victims don't stay sober. Victims don't stay sober. Let me tell you, I had a heart attack in 94 and almost died. Oh, it was pitiful. You should have watched me. Oh, my God, I've had a heart attack. Oh, yeah, I'm 59 years old. Next, my prostate will get 4 sizes too big and blow my bladder out. It's all over. They'll have to remove my prostate, and I'll be impotent, and then it'll all be over, you know. I blew my back out 3 weeks ago playing golf. Went down, had all these x-rays done, and they finally looked at me and said, you're a 60-year-old man with a 160-year-old back. They sent me to a physical therapist to start building my back up, and she said, ain't no sense in working on your back. Your whole body's shot. And I looked at her, I said, well, why? I said, because you haven't been doing a thing to take care of it. I exercised 4 years ago, Nautilus, for 1 year, and I was in perfect shape. After my heart attack, they had me on cardiac rehab for almost a year. I was in perfect shape. And 2 years ago, for some totally inexplicable reason, I just quit exercising. You know? And walked around playing golf and couldn't hit it out of my shadow. Somebody else said, oh, shit, I'm getting old. I can't play golf anymore. God, I'm serving you. I'm taking care of your children. I'm trying to eat right. I'm going to all these meetings and teaching these people. Why are you letting this happen to me? And he's saying, get on the treadmill, you idiot. Get on the treadmill. Victimization. Victimization and self-pity. Third part of the peculiar mental twist is what I call the square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome. If the square peg won't fit in the round hole, get a bigger hammer and just beat that sucker till it fits. I live my life half the time like I used to put my kids' Christmas toys together when I was drunk. It might start out to be a kite, but when it was over, if the damn thing rolled, that's what they got, you know? And that's the way I lead my life. You know, just drive that square peg in that round hole. And, of course, why am I trying to do that? It's the second half of the first step, what Scott called 1B. The second half of the first step, who's going to manage my life? By God, I am. And I'm going to do it till I nearly turn into stone because I'm not going to ride that treadmill. Because I want to do everything I want to do because I've got to control the results because I'm terrified if I don't get the results the way I want them, I can't deal with what I got. Absolute terror because I truly have to deal every day with the fact that I am bigger than God. When the real fear is that I can't deal with it because my seminal fear all my life is no matter what I got, I was not going to be adequate to handle it. Now, it achieved a whole lot for me for 40 years until the whiskey brought me to my knees to make me deal with the fact that you are not in charge of your life. You are responsible for the action, but damn it, God is responsible for the results, and he'll give you what you need to deal with them, whatever it may be. I remember people used to say, God won't give me more than won't give us more than you can handle. I think that sucks. And let me tell you why. What I found out is God won't give me more than we can handle. I will not have to deal with more today than we can handle. I remember when I was a year in the program, I came racing into a meeting one night, and I said, sat down next to my sponsor. He said, where you been? I said, God thinks I can do more than I can do, and I've just about had my belly full. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, I had to be at a hospital meeting at 7 on one side of town, a hospital meeting at 8 on one side of town. I had to be back to see my, and I had 45 appointments this afternoon, and I had to be at a staff meeting tonight, and I've come in here, and God is just, I'm just, he's, what do you mean? Just give me more than I can handle. And he said, would you do me a favor? And I said, what? And he said, would you bring your appointment book next week? I said, sure, Jim, why? And he said, well, I've just never seen God's handwriting, and I'd love to look at it. And because of me will continue to do these things and blame it on God. You know? But what God said is, hey man, I'll give you everything you need to deal with everything you got to deal with. Let me tell you about the second half of the first step. I've never seen anybody yet relapse over the first half of the first step that's ever been in an AA meeting. I've seen them relapse every time over the second half of the first step. There's not a person in this room that's alcoholic that doesn't know your power is over alcohol, and a significant number of you will drink again. And that's a statistical fact. And you won't drink again because you don't think your power is over alcohol. You'll drink because you'll get impaled on trying to manage your life and the fear that comes with it. Let me tell you. Let me give you an example. We have a test. Tom knows this better than I do, called the Michigan Alcohol Standardization Test, a MAST test. And when we're evaluating us to decide if we're alcoholic, there are a whole series of questions. And you give so many points to each of those questions. And if you have 5 points, there's a high probability, and each question is given a certain value score, you know, for its importance and all that stuff. And if you get 5 points or more, there's a high probability that you're alcoholic. And one of the questions is, have you ever been to an AA meeting? And if your answer is yes, that's 5 points. I mean, somebody's driving out here and I said, hey, there's the Ramada. They're having an AA conference. Let's go in. And I think it'll be fun to listen to them. You know, bullshit. You know, they're not going to do that. You didn't walk in here because it was a slow night. You know? And after you've dealt with enough people in this program like I had, you begin to look at this stuff and find it funny because you're going to go home tonight and think it was a slow night. You know? What did we know on the third part of the peculiar mental twist fear? Bigger than the rules, victimization, square peg, round hole, bigger hammer syndrome, self-centeredness, resentment, and self-pity. Thank you. By God, you are listening. I appreciate that. And obviously, your brain's better than mine. And the third one is fear. Now, what is the thing that will deal with this? It's what y'all taught me when I walked in. The only thing that'll deal with this disease of that kind of thinking is spirituality, right? Now, I got to tell you, I'm intimately knowledgeable about rational recovery, moderation management, secular organizations of sobriety, and all these organizations are people that say it doesn't require spirituality for recovery. Medical science today is beginning, literally, to develop mechanisms and pills where they can decrease craving. Will, in many instances, be able to stop the payoff from the drugs and the alcohol that we drank. And the pure scientist is even still believing that this is going to treat us. That doesn't take care of that hole in here, does it? This place where the wind blows through. And when we're in here together like we are tonight, that hole closes, doesn't it? You think there'll be a pill for that? Not on your life. Is there a pill that says love? Not on your life. If God is love, then we're with God tonight, right? And there ain't no pill going to do that. You got to decide if you've had enough and you want this. Bad enough to do what you got to do and walk through what you got to walk through. And I made the decision to do it. And I got to tell you, 20 years later, it's been the most fascinating, wonderful journey of my life. Has it all been a picnic? Ha! More? No. Has there been pain? Yeah. Has it been worth it? You bet your ass. Spirituality, the only answer for this program. Let me give you one of the things that has concerned me are the number of people in AA who want to make spirituality smoke, mirrors, and magic. Spirituality is not smoke, mirrors, and magic. Spirituality, for me, is a beautiful mystery. And it's for me to have the faith that I may not see the closing of this circle, but if I put in my parts on that circle, in many instances I have been blessed to see the closing of that circle. This is Michael on my breast, Burns. I saw the closing of that beautiful miracle. I saw this wonderful mystery come into fruition. And I absolutely grab anybody who's willing to work with me and say, it is not smoke, mirrors, and magic. It's a combination of God's power and my work. And the balance, if there is a balance in this program, is when I balance on a daily basis my activity and work and God's power and believe in both of them enough to run the risk to find it and do it. And I have developed for me, for my ability to tell where I am in the program, and I'll give it to you. Some of you who may think anally retentive like I do will appreciate this. But recovery for me is a triangle sitting on its point. And this point is embedded on a base. And this corner of that triangle is sponsor. This corner of that triangle is meetings. And this corner of that triangle, the big book. And it's sitting on this wonderful base of honesty and one day at a time. If you follow that spiritual program and inventory, when I am absolutely out in left field and can't hit my butt with either hand, all I got to do, have I talked to my sponsor? Have I talked to my sponsor? Have I gone to my meeting? Did I start my day with the way the big book outlines it? Am I being honest with me and my sponsor? Things like my sponsor, the first sponsor I had, said, you call me every day, and I figured out after about 2 months that he took a nap between 4 and 6. When did I call him? 4:30. 4:30. It took him about 2 weeks. Finally looked at me and said, come here. He said, let me tell you what you're doing. I thought, he said, are you being honest? Jim, I'm being honest with everything I do. He said, I'm bullshit. And he showed me what I was doing. I wasn't telling any lies and really didn't even consciously realize, but I had figured out because I didn't want to talk to that man. He scared hell out of me. You know, he really did. Yeah, honesty. Book says it. First paragraph, fifth chapter, three times. Anybody can make it if they can be honest. Nobody can make it if they can't be. I've had three sponsors. The first one was a true, true sociopath. And I'm telling you, he was. You think God doesn't send you what you need? He sent me what I needed. This man had no fear, no conscience, no shame, and absolutely was dedicated to beating the living hell out of me. But God absolutely knew with my rage and my terror and my medical degree that if I didn't have somebody in there, and with my mind, that I could turn wine to water and give me credit for it. And I had this man that would stand in my face with his finger in my nose, and I'm sure, and I'm going to tell you to this day, I know he liked it. He liked it. This man's a pervert. He truly was a pervert. He liked it. But I'll tell you what he did. When my mother died, I'd been sober 8 months, and I called this man, and he came out and sat in my office, and I climbed up in his lap, and he rocked me like a baby. He rocked me like a baby. When I had this situation where I was thinking about having this affair, I talked to him in great detail. He made sure that my wife knew it within 24 hours. Okay? But God knew what I needed because he was the only person big enough. I remember one night we were standing in my living room, and he looked at me, and Casey was sitting on the fireplace, and he looked at me and picked up a chair, and I said, I'm fed up with you, you big son of a bitch, and picked up a chair and drew it back, and he reached over. He's 6'5", weighed 260, and was 20 years older than me. He just picked up a chair and said, one more step, and I'll bring you, little bastard. And he would have done it and never missed a stitch. Now, am I saying that's the kind of sponsor you need? No, I'm telling you, God will give you the sponsor you need if you look for somebody that you literally will follow. Now, 9 years in the program, it was time to move on. Second sponsor taught me about love and tolerance. The second sponsor was Jack S., and Jack's not tolerant of much of anything, but I watched him develop the ability to be tolerant, and I wanted to know why, and he was my sponsor for 9 years. My second sponsor is a fellow who came in the program with me, and we've been together for about a year now, and I love him. And we meet for breakfast once a week, and I've never been without sponsored meetings. I found out various things about meetings. First thing I found out about meetings is that Alcoholics is a perfect, that AA is a perfect program composed of an awful lot of real sick people. And when Wilson drew up that deal and he said principles over personalities, he sure knew what he was talking about because I've watched many people get drunk at people. You know, when we came in the program, there were people hitting on my wife from the first day she walked in. Now, I didn't like that, but I understood it. There were people hitting on me, and that really did bother me because I looked like the wrath of God. Little bitty legs, little bitty arms, alcoholic acne, belly hanging out over my belt. I mean, I didn't even want to sleep with me, you know? And then I found out there are people in this program that hit on a stump. I mean, that's just the way it is. Well, I'm not going to AA because all they're doing in there is looking for women. You bet your life they're looking for women. I'm looking for men. But that's not the program of recovery. That's the individual sick personalities. And if you're going to let the personality keep you from going to AA meetings, then I need to tell you that that's why our stories tell us that it's principles over personalities. Found out that those that don't go to meetings don't hear what happens to them, don't go to meetings. And if you really want to know something really important, read There Is a Solution. We said there will come a day when we'll be unable to bring into our conscious memory with sufficient force the humiliation of a week or a month ago. We are defenseless. We forget. Medical science calls this state-conditioned learning. I call it one of God's greatest gifts, to be able to let that misery drift away, both by my actions and with time, but to give me a door to walk in, because every minute I walk in this door, I look at you and I'm gently reminded of every bit of that misery. And I'm grateful that I've worked through and turned it over. Because ask everybody who leaves us and gets drunk, they just forget. They just forget. What time did I start this? Okay, I want to spend the next few minutes, a minute or two, telling you how I got here. I've given you what you do need to stay here and get through recovery and do with it what you want to. It's my story, and I've given it to that person who wanted to hear it, and there may be a lot of you who do. I came in this program I grew up in a little town in Western Kentucky named Mayfield. I told you about my grandfather, told you about my mother. I became Jack Armstrong, the All-American boy, the night before I left to go to college. I remember, and I really was. I was one of the neatest kids you'd ever want to meet. I was laying in the bed looking up at the sky, or looking up at my ceiling, and I said, God, if I ever have a son, I want him to be just like me. Be careful what you pray for. You may get it. I got two kids. One of them's 36. She's pregnant with her first baby. Neat lady growing in his program. She's been in AA 16 years. I've got a son, 30. He's been in AA 13 years. Two of the neatest people I've ever seen. If you think I'm not grateful to AA, AA raised my children. Between AA and Casey, they raised my children. Because I didn't know how to raise my children, and God's going to give me a grandchild. If he sees fit, he's going to give me a grandchild. And I've been so blessed to watch Kenny and Gay love that little baby. Because I've been a little intimidated by what to do with this grandchild. And I've been projecting, by not staying in the day, how I'm going to relate to this grandchild, because children scare the hell out of me. You know, little children. And I realized that I don't have to worry about that, because God, I'm going to be fine. I'm going to be a hell of a granddaddy. I'm going to be one hell of a granddaddy, because I'm sober, and I'm grateful that that child's coming, and my children are healthy, and I'm going to be a good granddaddy. Went off to college. There was no problem. I went off to no problem in high school, no problem in college. When I started medical school, there's always been a motor running in me. You know, always been a motor running in me. The psychiatrists tell me that I have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. They tell me that I have severe affective panic disorders. They tell me I'm irritable. They tell me that I have stimulus augmentation. Now, all those are true diagnoses. They're accurate. The big book says I'm irritable, restless, and discontented. And that's exactly what I am. And I tell you, when I was in medical school that freshman year, I was flying apart, thought I wasn't going to be able to make it, and somebody walked up, and I was packing to go home. Somebody walked up and gave me this vial of pills called amphetamine. Said, take that, it'll help you study and stay awake. I took it, and my motor stopped. I found four things that'll stop my motor, just like that. Amphetamine, alcohol, sex, and Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one producer of endorphin, which is the brain's own morphine, is orgasm. You wonder why so many of us in this program start he-ing and she-ing from day one? I'll tell you why. Because we found out that besides feeling good and being hugged, when boom, 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 when that happens, I'm here to tell you that there you got more morphine flowing in your brain right then than if you were shooting at IV, you know? So what you do is put them on opposite sides of the room and a curtain between them and tell them to do whatever they got to do, but just get rid of it, you know? Don't do it. But I found four things. AA, the fourth thing. AA works best. It just takes longer. That's all they do. And they don't put you in jail for going to AA, and they put me in jail for all three of those other things. I didn't know that was a police woman. I thought $50 was a good price. I wasn't the same kid that grew up in high school, I'll tell you, by that time. I was immediately hooked on amphetamine, and my freshman year in medical school, 2 weeks before graduation, I was kicked out. And I spent a year and a half in psychiatric therapy, didn't take any amphetamine, got back in medical school a year and a half later, was strung out on amphetamine within 30 minutes when I walked back into school. My classmates enabled me. They took me home. My wife had called the medical school, tell them that I was, she told them I had the flu. They knew better, but they'd given it their best shot. I graduated in 1964, was in Our Lady of Peace, the mental hospital four times over the next 3 years, strapped down IV fluid, straight jackets, padded cells. We did not know at that time that amphetamine, which is like cocaine, had a tolerance to it. Today we know that it does. And I got to where I could just take one amphetamine and just go nuts and get demented, and they'd have to put me in a mental hospital. I could stay off of it 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months. Stayed off of it once almost for 2 years. Went back and whammed. Within 1 day, I was through. Went in the Army, almost got put in Leavenworth for taking amphetamine. Came home in 1969, been off of it for a year and got back on it again when I opened my practice. Had a gallbladder attack, which they partially attributed to amphetamine. Took my gallbladder out. My surgeon, my internist, who's still two of my best friends, two members of the board of Lashner, came and sat behind me and said, Burns, please quit taking amphetamine. It's killing you. You're a good man and a good doctor. Please quit. So I quit. I don't really think I thought I was powerless over it. I was tired of the consequences. So I quit. I never even tried to find out if I was powerless because I never took another amphetamine, but I started drinking. The first 4 years, I didn't drink alcoholically. I might get drunk, might stay sober. Never thought much about it one way or another. Next 3 years, I drank alcoholic. Didn't drink as much, didn't get drunk as often, but every minute of every day, I was thinking of that next drink. I knew exactly when it was going to happen. It was going to happen at 4:15. Out of my office, across the street, 7-Eleven, quart of beer between my legs, drank it going home, walk in, get my scotch and water, and get to be exactly where I wanted to be. And it was as predictable as the sun up and sun down. In the last year of my drinking, it turned on me. I drank a quart of whiskey a night and told myself I wasn't an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. Had to tell myself that because I didn't know any other way to live. Met Casey and knew if I didn't quit drinking, I'd lose her like I'd lost everybody else. Tried to quit drinking and couldn't. There was no way I could quit. I couldn't quit drinking. You've got to be an alcoholic to know that. You can't teach it to anybody. You just got to have been there. And I couldn't quit drinking. One morning she'd gone to work and I sat there and I said, God, I couldn't get drunk. I couldn't get sober. I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live without it. I hated my guts. I hated the dishonesty. I hated everything I'd become. I'd stomped on every value that I'd ever had. And they were decent values for my mother and daddy. It was a loving home. So decent values from the church, a little bit skewed, but it was good values, and I had just shit on every one of them, and I couldn't stand it. I said, God, please help me, and I knew immediately what I had to do. The relief was instant, and I walked in, and I loaded my shotgun because it was time to leave. I was helpless, and I was hopeless. I'd been deacon in 5 churches, and I'd had 8.5 years of psychiatric therapy. The church gave me stuff, psychiatry gave me stuff, but I couldn't quit drinking on the stuff they gave me. I couldn't. I didn't think there was any help. And where there's no help, there's no hope. Why do people commit suicide? I know. I've been there. I know exactly why. There's no perceived help and there's no perceived hope. What's the reason to stay? And I put the gun in my mouth and I thought, Casey will be better. Mom and Dad will be better. My partner will be better. And then I thought of my children and I choked on that. Because I could not believe my children would be better knowing their daddy died that way. I really couldn't do it. And I said, God, leave me alone. I just want to go. And I'd start to pull the trigger. Hell, dying? I didn't mind dying. Living, I was terrified of that. But I did not want my children to know their daddy died that way. And I threw the gun down and I said, you son of a bitch, leave me alone. And crawled to the phone and called somebody and I said, please help me. Because I knew I had no clue. I went to see him, and I said, I'll do anything you tell me to do. I turned my life and my will over to a psychiatrist who's 5'8", wears glasses, and stutters. And that was my first God. Psychiatrist that stutters is a little weird, right? He listens a lot. Sent me to New York City to Payne Whitney Clinic. You know Payne Whitney Clinic. And they sent me to Payne Whitney Clinic in Manhattan. And the reason was because I kept telling David, I'd say, David, I'm depressed. He said, well, you're depressed because you drink too much. And I said, no, I drink too much because I'm depressed. He said, no, you're depressed because you drink too much. And I said, no, I drink too much because I'm depressed. And he couldn't ever change my mind, you know. And I got to tell you, every drunk that walks in this program is depressed. And in 1 year, 92% of you will not be depressed. Within 4 weeks, 60% of you will not be depressed. And our big problem as doctors is to quit giving y'all medicine you don't need before you need it. Now, it's our job to understand that, and those like Jim and myself and some of the others that I know and some of you have in this community know that. But the majority of doctors still believe they got to treat that depression too damn quick, and you don't know any better. You don't know any better, but 92% of you will be clear. If you're taking antidepressants, I'm not telling you should or shouldn't take them. I'm just telling you what we know about alcoholics and recovery and drug addicts and recovery. You work the program, and interestingly enough, the depression will go away. You don't work the program, you can bet your ass you'll get depressed. And I don't care if you've been sober 30 years. The way I outlined it. Depression is predictable. So he sent me up there, and I saw my roommate hanging, called him, and I said, I'm a drunk. I may be depressed, but I'm a drunk. Sent me to Atlanta, and I got in a treatment program for 2 to 3 months, came home, got into AA. When I walked into AA, I was home, and I started my journey. First year was crazy as hell. We have a post-acute recovery syndrome that Wilson described beautifully in his story. So he couldn't get a job for 1.5 years because he's racked with waves of self-pity and resentment. In 1979, medical science studied us and said, the alcoholic will lose short-term memory for 6 months to 2 years. Simple problem solving and stress management screwed up 6 months to 2 years. Sleep patterns screwed up 6 months to 2 years, and ain't no way you can speed that up. Depends on how old you are, how much you've been drinking, what other drugs are involved, but you're going to be playing with sawdust for brains for 6 months to 2 years, and you can take it to the bank, and you can't speed it up. And those who've been through it, you have to grab a hold of one of them and say, have I got sawdust brains? Yes, you do, honey. I sure do love you. Come on, let's go to the meeting. Am I making any sense? Not a damn bit, but come on, that's perfectly all right. We'll go to a meeting. Don't get more than 1 foot of chain or you'll screw it up. I'm just telling you that. That's just the way it is. First night I got my first year token, I just stood there and cried. And everybody thought, he's crying with happiness. I was crying because I didn't have a clue. But I knew I wanted to stay sober. More than anything else, I want to say. Second year, I started getting better. By the end of the second year, I became a little Mr. AA. Get up on time, do your meditations, get to the office, see your patients at home, and go to the meeting, greet the newcomer, set up the ashtrays. Hell, I had it wired. I was little Mr. Perfect AA by that time, you know? And then after 5 years, I'm walking around like this. The old timers look at me and say, how you doing, Merce? Fine, this is a smile, you idiot. I mean, I was so dry you could have set me on fire with a fart. That's exactly where I was. Visiting my spiritual director in South Georgia, Thomasville. I had a spiritual director. We don't talk much about him anymore, but I had a spiritual director and a sponsor, and they stayed in close, conscious contact with each other. And I was visiting Jimmy Law, my spiritual director, down in South Georgia, and I walked in to see Jimmy and was just flying apart, went back to the motel, and Casey, I said, Casey, God, have God take away the pain. And she said, call your sponsor. And I called my sponsor, and this man had a two-step program. I've already told you about it. Let me tell you what he told me. I said, Jim, I'm flying apart. And he said, do you believe you'll get this program? I said, I don't know. He said, come home, we'll talk about it. And I started hanging up, and he said, let me ask you something. He said, do you believe if you work these steps perfectly, it'll make you good? And I said, yeah. And he said, you're wrong. He said, do you believe if you get drunk today, it'll make you bad? And I said, yeah. And he said, you're wrong. I said, I don't understand. He said, Burns, you've been trying to buy something that isn't for sale. It's given for fun and for free. God loves you just the way you are. You can't earn it and you can't kick it away. You're God's child, and you will always be. Drunk, sober, wrong bed, right bed. You want to feel good about yourself, you better stay on the right side of it. But God loves you just the way you are. And I was ready. And if there's anybody in this room that doesn't believe it, you take mine and Scott's God. You take Jim and Casey's God. You take John and Gay and Kenny's God and Jim. Because one day you'll know God loves you just the way you are. Then I went on my journey of self-indulgence. Casey and I were essentially celibate for 4 years. I continued to work a program starting at 10 years, and she was working an incredible program. And between those programs, we knew there had to be a resolution to this relationship. She had wanted me to go into therapy with her for a long time, and I said, when hell freezes over, get your skates, folks. We're going to skate tonight right on hell, you know. And we went in, and the big book says that's fine. We walked into therapy about 4 years ago with two of the most powerful programs I've ever known. And someone who really respected our 12-step solution guided us into a level of intimacy that eventually developed into a level of sexual appreciation, because I had always blocked intimacy with sex. And I found a wife I could love, and she loved me. She never quit. And I never quit loving her. We have one of the finest, strongest, most beautiful marriages I've ever seen. But it took a lot of work. And I watch people say, you work your program, let her work her program, it'll be okay. Bullshit. You work your program, let her work her program, and y'all work on your marriage together, because those who don't do that may have wonderful spiritual programs, and that means they'll kiss each other goodbye and say, I wonder why it didn't work. Today, I know I stand on the shoulders of some very, 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 very beautiful and powerful people. But due to this program you've given me, I live in the shadow of nobody. The big book in the promise before the promise said, if we're sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble as God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anybody. Beautiful spiritual interaction. I will tell you some of my family in about 2 minutes and I'm home. My children today say the most important person in their life was their daddy drinking, and the most important person in their daddy's life was their daddy sober. I listened to my son give an AA talk in Bessemer, Alabama with me and Casey, and I sat and I just absolutely was amazed. I listened to my daughter the other night talk, and I watched two beautiful young adults. I'm really grateful for my sobriety, but I got to tell you, I may even be more grateful for theirs. My mother died in 1978, and I was 8 months sober, and I got to go down and make my amends to mother. Mother and I were never far apart. We were true soulmates, and I think of my mother every day. I miss her a lot, and I love her a lot. I've always loved my mother. Oh, I went through a period of time, victimization, where I blamed her for a whole bunch of crap, but I always loved my mother. When my mother died, my daddy, within a year's time, married somebody, wonderful friend of the family. I used to try to make my amends to my daddy. My daddy has always been, everywhere I've been, my daddy's been there. He just appeared. He's always just appeared. I played ball, he was there. I was sick, he was there. My daddy was just always there. He never would say, I loved you. He never criticized me. Daddy was just always there. And when I sobered up, I went to daddy to make my amends, and daddy wouldn't listen. He just turned and walked away and said, I don't need to talk about it, Burns Mac. Not harsh. I'm an addictionist for a 200-man homeless shelter. And I teach two classes there that are in the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapter, and I've done at least 65th steps with those men. I've rocked them in my lap, and some of these men can eat that wall. What I found out is every man would give anything for a significant male to say, I love you, and it's okay. There'll be a day when it isn't necessary, but it will always feel good. And I wanted Daddy to say that to me, and Daddy couldn't. And I know why, and I can't tell you that. Daddy then began to lose his mind. He didn't know who I was, didn't know who my brother was, and then didn't know my mother had ever been alive. It just went. Peggy was a wonderful lady, and we put Daddy in a nursing home. He had Alzheimer's and or senile dementia. And I would drive down pretty much every weekend, or at least frequently, to go see my daddy in the nursing home, and I'd say, God, take away my pain. And I'd go in there, and I'd work with daddy all day, and then I'd leave, and I'd cry all the way back 250 miles, and it never worked. About this time, all this wonderful miracle was occurring in my life of this increasing insight and resolution by the steps. And I drove down this one Sunday and parked my car, and I said, Dear God, let me be for my daddy today what you want me to be. And I walked in. He's in a wheelchair, so weak, and I didn't call him daddy. That confused him. I said, How can I help you? And he thought I was his brother, Buster. And he said, Yeah, Buster, would you shave me? So I shaved my daddy. And I said, Let me take you and get you some lunch. So he said, I'd really like to have it. So I rolled him in there. He's too weak to feed himself, so I was feeding him. Peggy came in and sat down about where you're sitting, and she and I got to talking like that, and Daddy was sitting in a wheelchair watching, and Mother and I used to do that all the time with talking. Daddy loved to watch us talk. He just watched. Daddy never said much. He was a real quiet man. And Mother and I would just yak, 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 and Daddy watched. He loved to watch. He was watching Peggy and me talk. I turned around and said, How would you like to go down on the sun porch? And he said, I believe I would. I rolled him out there, and then Peggy and I sat down, and we got to talking. Daddy's sitting there watching. He raised up in his chair, and he looked me right straight in the face, and he said, Son, today you just like the little boy your mother and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. 10 seconds later, he didn't know who I was and never did again. We buried him 3 years ago. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is not that my daddy recognized me, is it? It's that this self-centered alcoholic said, Dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. The miracle of recovery is not a change in what I see. It's a change in how I see it. Don't let the opportunity go by for the rest of this night. Don't let it go by. Thank you for asking me to come. Thank you for listening to me. You've been very patient and allowed me to say what I needed to say. For those people that I've seen again, it's good to see you. For those people that I've met for the first time, welcome into my life. For those I didn't get to meet, we will meet. As we trudge this road of happy destiny, let's try to do it at God's speed. It works best. May God walk with you, and may you walk with Him. I love you. Good night.